Welcome to Just an Average Citizen, the podcast that helps to educate, inform, and empower you to make an impact in Abilene and the Big Country. Welcome back to part two. I tried to squeeze it in, but I just have so much great information to share of these foundational books. And, you know, maybe I should just give up trying to squeeze it in about 30 to 45 minutes. That's really my goal because there's so much to talk about and discuss. And I know that a book by the bite probably shouldn't be as long as it is because it feels like more like a portion. So I've kind of stepped out of the definition of what I really try to do, but there are some really heavy topics that I've been trying to address, and I think it takes a little bit more effort or a little bit more time devoted to explain some of the things going on because you'll miss some of it if you don't have the background history. And so hopefully I'll find my rhythm and make them more consistently palatable in about 30 to 45 minutes. But anyway, let's move on because I'm making this long again. So if you didn't get to catch up on the first podcast of this book, the part one of this book, it's the week before. And you just check that out. And we talk about the background of this author and her journey to find freedom in America. And it's very powerful and poignant for today. The beginning of her story, or the full portion of her story, once she escapes from her human trafficking situation scenario, and even learns to find a little taste of success in her life, is in her first book, In Order to Live by Yunomi Park. It's a fabulous, fabulous podcast, a fabulous book. And I really thought, like I said, this last, the first part, that's the book I thought I was going to share until I started researching. I realized there was actually another book that we're talking about now, While Time Remains. And so this is her experience once she became able to live in America. She lived in New York primarily in this journey, or this season of her journey in the book. And she explains what it's like to be a defector, a North Korean defector, search for the freedom in America. And so we talked about a lot of stuff in the first part that was really good. And so now we're going to finish up basically the last half of the book. You know, there's a lot of background information that you'll miss and may not understand, so I would encourage you to go back. But if you would subscribe and share this with family and friends, that would be awesome. I really feel like this particular episode of the podcast really helps you to talk about relevant and current cultural issues that we're dealing with even here in Abilene, Texas. And so I want to empower you and help you be informed and educated on how you can recognize that we are not in a bubble here. We are not we don't get to miss out on a lot of what's going on that we see in the news or we hear about. And we want to be prepared and ready to have an answer for why we believe what we believe. And as we talked about, just to connect these two parts, the last thing that I think really that stood out from the first part of this book is that when you are deprived of human relationships, part of you becomes numb inside and you forget that you have worth and value. And so if you can't be yourself around people because you have to step around all these landmines that you're not allowed to talk to, there's a real insecurity that begins to foster inside of you because you don't know if they really believe they like you for who you are, they love you for who you are, they want to be around you for who you are, or who you're pretending to be. And sadly, so many people are walking in this fear of being known because there is a right and a wrong way to live here in Abilene, Texas. There is an approved narrative that has existed and functioned so well for so long. And thankfully, COVID exposed some of it and help us to wake up and go, oh, wait, we don't have to all live in groupthink. We don't always have we don't have to be and do like everyone else. We can actually have our own thoughts and opinions, and it's okay to share them. And I did mention last time that I've noticed there's like this mentality that once there's an approved message or approved a person in charge, then everyone gathers around and circles the wagons and they protect that at all costs. And anyone who won't join the circle gets demoralized, disparaged, and spoken of critically in ways that are not really kind or honoring. And it's not because they have something wrong with them. It's just they've stepped away from the way it's supposed to be, the approved way it's supposed to be. And so I would love to be a part of helping make sure that we are able to have the conversations. Because again, just because we're benefiting from this groupthink doesn't mean that's something we should be satisfied with, because groupthink is dangerous. And if you stick with me a little bit longer, you'll understand groupthink is a destructive thing that it demoralizes you because you are unable to use your own brain that God has given you to have use critically think. So let's continue with this book so we can get through this in a reasonable amount of time and you can take from it what you need to empower you to make an impact where God has called you to really influence in Abilene and the big country. All right, so here we're at chapter 5, Values in Decline. She says, "What I love most about the United States of America, both in theory and practice, is it's a commitment to each individual's unalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's difficult to communicate to Americans who are born here just how unusual that last right is as a value, let alone being a value held by the state. Most countries are committed to either abstract ideas like the glory or the majesty or the destiny of people or government, or to something ruthlessly practical like its own security or survival." It's about starting. So I struggled with this because I feel like feelings are fleeting and I don't like this idea that you have the right to pursue happiness. But again, if you don't understand the cultural context when this was written, it's like what you desire inside, what makes you. Happiness is not like, oh, I'm so happy, you know, that the sun is shining, or I'm so happy that I get to live in a house that has two bathrooms, or I'm so happy. Like, it's not about happiness like in the external, the things that don't really matter to you. It's about your core, right? And so in the pursuit of happiness, that is something our nation proudly protects because it gives you the freedom to be yourself, right? It's your identity. And I know that's a rough translation of that, but if you look back into the founding documents and you look back to original sources, you can see that's really what the happiness is talking about. It's not about being able to have access to any kind of employment, that being able to be employed anywhere you want to. You don't have that right, but you have the opportunity to have access to get those jobs. You don't have a right to every job, if that makes sense. Even if that makes you happy, that's not your right. So she talks about the right to pursue happiness. The Jeffersonian image of the right to pursue happiness is not of the Wolf of Wall Street leaving trails of lies, drug abuse, broken relationships, and professional and familial wreckage. It's about starting your own business, owning your own property, raising your own family, and participating in your own community in whatever way you see fit within the bounds of law and the respect of rights of others. She said, "In the midst of arguing that gender is a construct, complaining about toxic masculinity and mansplaining, declaring that the idea of a protector or provider is sexist, that marriage is outdated, and that children rob you of your freedom, no one seemed to stop and wonder if they might be personally responsible for their own unhappiness." And it's interesting that she would compare our country to North Korea and saying that at least in North Korea, we knew our purpose and our place. And we held that part. I mean, the family was a strong unit, you know, but here she's in Colombia and everyone's like, you know, live for yourself, stay up late, go out drinking, have a good time, you know, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. But so many people are unhappy and they're blaming their circumstances. And she said, but could it be that your choices are making you unhappy because you're not really pursuing the things that you want? You're pursuing these shallow endeavors that offer nothing in the end. She says, even in a country like North Korea, which places as little value on human life as possible as is possible to do, pregnancy and childbirth are still considered by the people who go through it, as opposed to the state, as sacred and precious. It is inconceivable for a North Korean woman to weigh cost-benefit analysis for having a child the way many women, American women, are encouraged to do. They value life, even though they're being treated in such a poor way. They still have a value for life that she doesn't always see in Americans. It was then that I realized what happiness is. It's nothing other than a synonym for love and gratitude. So here's where I'm just going to say, yeah, that's a great interpretation, but it's not what it really was about. But for her, that's where she found an understanding for her grid, because again, she didn't have words in her language for stuff like this. Happiness is not a material success or recognition or even comfort. It's becoming a parent, being a good daughter, being a good friend, and lending a helping hand to anyone less fortunate. What this meant was that finding meaning in life was not an arduous search that may or may not end in gratification, meaning, it turns out, is not difficult to find at all. As many wise people have pointed out, happiness is a choice. My mother once told me that without gratitude, happiness is impossible. When I asked God for happiness, she said, He tells me instead to learn to be grateful. She and he was right. And I think that's a little bit of a nuance, but I just wanted to say that, you know, again, happiness, our identity, what makes us have worth and value comes from God and knowing that. All right, now we're to chapter 6, victimhood and oppression. If suffering is experienced in the brain only, as opposed to physical forms of suffering like torture or disease, then by definition, that suffering is a decision. That's powerful. If it's only experienced in the brain, then you choose to suffer because you choose to. That's why I strongly believe that the great majority of the suffering we experience is actually caused by ourselves and the decisions we make or don't make. In other words, feelings of devastation mostly come from the way we think about the problem, rarely from the problem itself. And I can tell you, as a person of faith, that has been a game changer for me. Rather than looking at the crises that come my way, I stop looking and I'm going, oh my gosh, this is so overwhelming. And I say, okay, God, you're my provider, you're my protector, you're my defender. How are you going to make this right? Because you say in your word that you work all things for good for those who love you and are called according to your purpose. I love you and I know I'm called according to your purpose. So how are you going to work this for good? Sometimes we experience suffering because we choose to make bad decisions. And sometimes we just have to walk through hard things because it's growing in us. And sometimes we just walk through hard things, right? But it's a choice on how you look at it. It's your perspective. And as people who understand that we are our lives are in God's control, our hands, I can't think of the right way to say this, but we know that God is in control of all things. And we know that he can work in our lives if we trust him. She says that human suffering is an actual unnecessary suffering. She said the third and biggest element in human suffering is actually unnecessary suffering. That type is within our control to stop, and that is our own doing in the first place. We know perfectly well when we are being lazy or irresponsible or greedy or making foolish choices. A certain degree of suffering is natural, even essential to human life, but the only way the only path for riding the ship is to be completely, entirely at one with yourself, to be authentically you. And if you cannot have hard conversations, if you cannot say what you think, then you are not operating fully as you. Now, I'm not saying we have to say all things to all people, but you know that when you're around people, if you can't blurt those inappropriate thoughts and people look at you and go, you're weird, and walk away from you? Or can you utter those inappropriate thoughts that come out from time to time? And they're like, oh my goodness, that's crazy. That's not who you are. What's going on? What's up? You know, or let's talk this through. You know, we can't hold it all in, and we have to have a safe group and inner circle that it knows us, knows our thoughts, and doesn't judge us for our mistakes or the times that we act out of character for us, but they know our character and they believe and honor and pour in, you know, speak life into that so that we can continue to be more of who we were created to be. And I'm so grateful I have that circle. Some of the outer circles don't really value or get me, but that's okay because, you know, I know that I can be authentically me more and more around people who don't get me. And that to me is more freedom than I ever have known in my entire life, where I don't have to pretend to be something I'm not. The attacks and accusations are totally monolithic, but they didn't. Okay, so she's talking here when she has been a target of being called right wing or far right for what she said in public about the Chinese and North Korean regimes. She says she's been canceled and they've been motivated. She's also been canceled by her criticisms of Americans' own political culture, which reminded her of the totalitarian tendencies I know so well from my early life. She said, the attacks and accusations are never totally monolithic, but they do tend to come from one political camp in particular. Americans who consider themselves Marxist, Leninist, Maoist, Communist, Socialist, Democratic Socialist, or more broadly, the left. I've noticed that these fellow Americans of mine seem to work mostly in schools, universities, media, large corporations, NGOs, foundations, activist organizations, and government bureaucracies. They tend not to be first-generation immigrants, but people who were born in America, and thus people who've never actually lived under the kind of political and social systems they believe to be superior to America's capitalist democracy. See if this goes on. The same people who accused her of being outside the boundaries of acceptable political discourse for criticizing communism tends to be the same people who are most visible and influential in the world her young son is entering. And they are committed to supporting the ideology that bears a close resemblance to the one from which I barely escaped, leftism. It is important to distinguish leftism from liberalism, and I think this is key here. Liberalism has its foundation in liberty and individual rights, freedom of speech, of press, of religion, and of the market. Leftism has its foundation in the centralization of these rights, not in the individual, but in groups organized and directed by the state. Liberalism values color blindness, that the color of one's skin determines and should determine nothing. Leftists believe that almost everything in society can and should be determined by race alone. Liberalism promotes racial integration and inclusivity. Leftism promotes increased racial segregation and exclusion. So, they differ on how they view capitalism as well. She says, capitalism, the only proven method for liberals, this is the only proven method, capitalism, of bringing the greatest number of people possible out of poverty. For the leftist, capitalism is the greatest cause rather than the solution to poverty and must be extinguished through the elimination of free markets and greater centralization of state power of the economy and individual decision making. And what's funny is the people who complain the most about all that's wrong with our country are really complaining a lot of times of the socialism, that the socialistic policies and practices that we have in our nation, and they don't realize they're actually complaining about the things that they want to actually put into place, and it doesn't end well. We've read the story. We know the end of the story in so many ways. It doesn't end well for centralization of state power. I mean, we're seeing it lived out literally in our nation right now. We have a federal government, an executive leader, a branch, our president saying that it is not okay for us just to let as many people come into our nation without any kind of standards whatsoever. And the things that I've been hearing about what's happening at our border is unbelievable. And half of the states have said we're in agreement. This federalized government is failing us. So the states are stepping up for the first time way later than I'd hoped. But we're seeing this even happen here and now. It's crazy to me. Okay, so the English. So again, it's so important to know how our nation was founded. So many people believe that taxation without representation was one of the most important factors in our Declaration of Independence. And it's like one of, what is it, 27? And it's like number 17. It's like way at the bottom of the list. But that's what we always talk about. In actuality, the United States might have been born as a reaction to monarchical tyranny in the late 18th century, but its deepest roots reach back a century and a half earlier. The English religious exiles who chose to make the difficult and dangerous journey across the Atlantic world did so in search of greater individual and communal liberty. It was an exodus in search of truth and freedom. There was no plan B. They had no plan B. If they weren't able to succeed in the colony, the other option was death everywhere else in the world. That doesn't seem like a very hopeful situation. They left behind the sacrifices they made for the sake of that search were almost unfathomable. They left behind everything they ever knew and embarked on an entirely uncertain path. Our forefathers, so let me just say this, and we so honored their journey for freedom from this tyranny that they faced, that we as a nation paid to erect a statue in Plymouth, Massachusetts, called the Monument to Our Forefathers. Look it up. The federal government paid money to put a monument to honor our forefathers who gave up everything to experience freedom here in this new land. Our forefathers in America were willing to undergo such extreme conditions and assume such dangers all for the sake of freedom and religion. That's not what you hear most these days. And you go to the Mayflower too in Plymouth, like you can go to the monument. And then you go to the Mayflower, and it's like you're living in two different worlds. It says on the Mayflower, too, that they were just coming to America to get a better job. Do you know what it's like to move cities because you want a better job? It's like so sterilized and so sanitized. It's not even the same story. It was very disappointing when I got to experience both two extremes and to be respectful of the people who were on the boat giving the history that they've been approved to give. And I say approved because I think if they knew the real story, they probably would be sharing it better, or I hope they wouldn't be working there. But that's a story for another day. So sorry. Okay. So here we are. I'm actually at the end. Here we go. But the American Civil Liberties Union, I love this, understood that the First Amendment allowed the freedom of peaceful assembly no matter the content. In fact, it was the same law that was used to defend the rights of civil rights protesters to march through the South. So the ACLU knows when you have your rights being stepped over. And sometimes I have seen them actually stand up for causes they don't believe in, but not very often. But they understood that. And so they defended the First Amendment rights of the Nationalist Socialist Party of America and won the case in the Supreme Court. The ACLU understood that there was no right is more sacred than the right to free speech, no matter the consequences. Okay. Again, we don't fight for the right ideas to be shared, but we fight for the ability for everyone to be able to freely share their ideas within reason. And there are limitations because that's what good laws have. They have limitations that it's not a free-for-all, right? Many have come up with an extra legal strategy for suppressing speech they don't like, what is known as cancel culture. And what is so dangerous about cancel culture, she mentions it here, is that it's not enforced by law. It's enforced by culture. Like, fellow Americans are canceling each other because they don't like what's being said. And that is that's soft totalitarianism. They don't have to make laws against what we do. We do the dirty work for them. And that's what's so frustrating here in Abilene sometimes is we find that we don't have to have a law to stop it. It's allowed or to allow it. It's allowed because that's what is approved. And I'm still uncovering and learning more about this, but we don't need to police each other. That's what communist natures do. They police each other. We need to give people the space to be who they were created to be and let them express their ideas freely and not do all this, you know, shaming people and shutting them down because they would say something that you don't agree with. I'm baffled by how much people feel the need to state their ideas in a negative and condescending way to you, because it's like, if they say it, then it's just like, keep those thoughts to yourself, people. You don't have to tell me everything you think. And trust me, I keep a lot of those thoughts to myself too. I do laugh because I talk a lot, but I filter a whole heck of a lot out. So, okay. The real power in cancel culture, listen to this. The real power of cancel culture is the fear that instills in the minds of ordinary people. And there's been a couple times where I've had to do the right thing knowing 100% what the consequences were. And I knew I couldn't look myself in the face in the mirror if I didn't do the right thing. And I knew I would be canceled in certain social spheres. And I've been canceled for other things too. And again, I was even doing something the other day, and it's like, in new environments, I really struggle with how to have conversations because I don't want to say anything that offends or divides or isolates people. And so it's like minding my P's and Q's, even though I'm completely confident that I have worked through that process really well, but I still sometimes don't even trust myself because there's fear of doing it wrong. And man, that's a tactic of the enemy. And so people are afraid of what it might cost them. And so we got to start back to that whole perspective. You can find a lot of good in circumstances if you look at it the right way. It's not that we'll lose, but what will we gain? We may lose some things, but we're going to gain a whole lot more. And like I tell people, once you've experienced your first battle of cancel culture, you realize they really don't have much power over you. So I always like to say, come on in, and the water's great. it's not crowded. You're not going to be amongst the masses, but you're going to certainly be about those people that you can trust and count on to back you up. Because they understand you've paid a price. It's a club that requires a membership due quite frequently. You have to pay to be a part of this club. And it's not a club exclusive to people. You just got to be willing to pay the price. Okay. This is the object of cancel culture in America. Deprive people of the right or ability to express their thoughts that run counter to official narratives so that eventually they don't even know how. Threaten enough people with destruction of their reputations and their livelihoods if they criticize the wrong thing and eventually they won't even know how to criticize it. So it just reminded me of the baker in Colorado. Like literally he was set up to be attacked by a group who wanted to make him a test case. And it's still going on 10 years later. And this man has done nothing wrong, but these people have used the courts for evil to make him spend millions of dollars just to defend his right to be able to say, I'm not going to make you a cake that I don't agree with. And you can go find a baker who will. I'm not denying you to make you a cake, period. I'm saying I'm not making that cake. It has nothing to do with you. It has to do with my religious convictions. And that's a serious price to be a part. And I haven't paid that at all. But it's like they want to take away our livelihood so that we can't work. And what's sad is a lot of us comply. And we're like, well, I don't want to lose my job. And we've positioned ourselves so where we can't lose our job and we can't do the right thing because our job has become so much an integral part of our lives that we can't shift and maneuver. And we put our feet in concrete and we don't have the agility that we need to be able to move, especially in this day and time. If you're not preparing to have something taken away for you for standing up for the right thing, then you've got to have you're going to have a rude wake up call or you'll continue to not say anything and be part of those good men who allow evil to go on, which is worse than the evil that's going on. Okay, so if an online mob decides it's racist, I think I chose not to include that quote. Okay, so calling me too political is like YouTube determining that I'm racist, a way to shut down all conversations and label things I say beyond the pale, regardless of the truth. So she was doing great in YouTube. She had a great following, millions of views, all this stuff. And then she started criticizing the CCP and it shifted and caused problems. And she was canceled from an FBI field office in Dallas because they didn't explain. They just said they didn't. The diversity department called and canceled her and said she wasn't welcomed. With use of modern technologies, cancel culture in America has made a significant amount of progress towards accomplishing what no democratic regime is capable of doing on its own and what every dictatorial regime in history has mastered, making humans, beings with unfavorable opinions disappear with the push of a red button. The targeted individual is presumed innocent until proven guilty. In our system, a judge has to issue a warrant. This is traditional. Judge has to issue a warrant. If the warrant is granted, police officer has to identify and make an arrest, and he must find the individual, detain him, and put him in custody. Throughout the process, the targeted individual is presumed innocent until guilty and granted the rights of an innocent person. Only at the end of that long, complicated process can we say that the regime made someone disappear. So once they've gone to prison, okay, and we've seen this even happen in our time, that innocent people have been taken to prison. I've even seen it here locally. It's crazy, the court system and what they give bail to. Like, it's like these heavy offenders get this little slap on the wrist and these very minimal issues are given a lot more significant. The bar is set higher for them to meet a standard that it seems impossible. I don't understand how it works and how they could do it, but it happens. But if you are convicted of the courts and you're put in prison, then you can be taken away. I mean, you can disappear, even though it's a long, lengthy process. So it happens, but it takes a long time to do it. It's not something that can happen really overnight, although it has because of. It's another story for another day. But anyway, dictatorships are subject to no process. Okay, so if you're a dictator, you don't have to worry about who knows who's going to stand up, who's going to argue. You just do what you want to do. No questions are asked. There's no warrant, trial, judge, or jury. With no trial, judge, or jury, with no verdict, no sentence, in a word, no due process, YouTube demonetized her video. Instagram has obstinately shadow banned my account at times. Organizations have invited me to speak about my own life, suddenly revoked the invitations on account of my undesirable opinions. So it's about locking ordinary citizens out of social participation if their opinions are considered undesirable by the media, corporations, and government. It is as serious as it gets. So we can say, oh, that it's not that big of a deal. It actually is. You're being cut out of social life. And I know then the mandates happen after 2020, You know, we weren't allowed to go wherever we wanted to go. We were limited to certain places, and people restricted us from freely moving about because of unpopular opinions that we, positions we took to protect our health and our family. And it's a disgusting part of our history that has still not been completely made right at all. So a mere modest proposal is to recommit ourselves to founding principles of our founding fathers and their forebears to freedom of speech, expression, and assembly. This means doing what the ACL did in Skokie, Illinois, prioritizing the law over our own feelings. In other words, we must take the path of resistance. Like the pilgrims, we must take the road that makes us uncomfortable, that is uncertain and frightening, if that's what the truth demands, because that is the only road to freedom. Okay. Oh my goodness. I skipped a bunch of chapters. I forgot about that. Make sure I'm on the right page. Yes, I am doing it. We're moving and grooving, and it's still, I'm almost about time to wrap it up. Whoa. All right. So this is the part that I think I was most grateful for, because there's only so much my brain can look into, and I am pulling threads left and right trying to understand stuff. And so that she put it here in this neat presentation really made me appreciate it. So the People's Republic of Chains. All right, Chinese Revolution of 1911, which replaced China's 2,000-year-old imperial system with the Republic of China, headed by Sun Yat-sen. In March of 1912, Sun soon resigned and was succeeded by Yuan Shikai, who attempted to reinstate an imperial system with himself as emperor, leading Sun to start one of China's first modern political parties, the Kuomintang. Or KMT, soon fought hard to establish a representative democracy, but was largely unsuccessful. Now, this part I was really surprised by. You know, there was another rebellion, but it had to do with foreigners, because foreigners were running China, I think is what I understand. And she said that in 1917, China entered the World War I on the side of the Entente. I don't know how to say that word. Sorry. I wasn't planning on reading it. With France, Britain, and Russia, China contributed to the alliance mostly by providing resources in form of laborers who worked in allied mines and factories. Nevertheless, after the war, the victor's peace, the Treaty of Versailles, ignored China's pleas to end the nightmare of foreign control. Instead of seceding Chinese territories previously held by the defeated German Empire back to Chinese themselves, for example, the treaty simply handed it over to Japan. So they went from one foreign entity to another. So on May 4th, 1919, 3,000 Chinese students demonstrated in Tiananmen Square to protest the Treaty of Versailles. And I have to confess, I was ignorant that it had to do with the Treaty of Versailles. I thought it had to do with something China had done. So I got a new brain wrinkle there for sure. Chinese society values with more contemporary. The May 4th movement was part of a larger cultural mobilization aimed at replacing traditional Chinese society and values with more contemporary and future oriented ones, which included promoting scientific endeavors, improving literacy, and making political participation more egalitarian, there you go, or populist. It was out of the May 4th movement that the Chinese Communist Party was soon born. Okay, so then there's some more stuff that happened, but in a war that broke out July 7th, 1937, between the Republic of China and Imperial Japan, is considered by most historians to mark the beginning of World War II, not Hitler's invasion of Poland, which came over 2 years later. In the aftermath of World War II, there was chaos and tumult in China as the struggle between the nationalists and the communists broke out into 4 years of civil war. By 1949, the CCP, led by Mao Zedong, finally defeated the KMT, and China was at last, from that moment through the present day, a communist state. Okay, so I remember when we were walking around downtown Abilene a couple years ago, and I was walking next to this young gentleman, and somehow we got on the topic of religious wars have killed more people in history than any other thing. And I was learning how to have conversations because of a great book called Tactics by Greg Kugel. And he talked about letting people just kind of help them explain themselves so they could maybe even in discussing it, they would see the flaws in their position. And a lot of people, that's the problem, is they haven't connected all the dots. And so they just have the big picture. And once you start to realize there's no support to a lot of these ideologies that people believe, it's helpful to them. It's not helpful for me to say, you see this hole? Do you see this hole? Right. And so, and he said all the religious wars. And I said, okay, let's think of all the religious wars we can think of. And we went through and I asked him what amount he thought had died. And I gave him generosity. And I think we came up with 50 million of people who might've died in religious wars. Again, it wasn't factual. It was just us, you know, talking about stuff, trying to understand numbers to get our head to wrap around what's really been more tragic. And so then in here, I think I'm a little closer to that part, but I'm premature. It just says, from his earliest days, Mao promised the Chinese people that should now be familiar to you, a socialist paradise. Okay. There would be no private companies owned by capitalist fat cats, no blood-sucking landowners abusing their labors, no unemployment in the cities, no more hunger, no more bloodshed. And indeed, Mao nationalized everything, eliminated private property, and confiscated land from private owners. The result was one of the greatest human catastrophes in history. Okay, so this is one of these examples of how it has failed miserably. Between 1958 and 1962, okay, this is not a religious war because this was by the communist. It considered China suffered the worst famine in human history. As a direct result of Mao's land and property policies, which were part of the Great Leap Forward, between 15 and 55 million people starved to death. In 1966, they began the decade known as the Cultural Revolution, in which up to 20 million people were murdered in the ostensible attempt to purge China of ideological opposition to communism and his absolute rule. By the time he died, 90% of the population was living in abject poverty, making less than $2 a day, and almost everyone had lost a parent, grandparent, child, or sibling to famine or massacre. It is estimated his rule, his policies, his government, his leadership is personally responsible for up to 78 million human deaths in this socialist paradise. So it didn't take long for us to start talking about the different leaders in history who weren't religious and how we're talking a whole heck of a lot more people have died under communism and socialist than have ever even, not drop in the bucket, but I mean, compared to religious wars. And that was me being generous with his overestimated numbers because we didn't have data in front of us. And so it's just crazy how we still don't recognize it. We're more offended by the Crusades. We're more offended by, thinking about in Spain, the Catholic, like there's horrendous things that happen there. I'm not denying the horrendous nature of it, but the sheer volume of deaths occurred have far, there's no comparison. Okay. So over the ensuing decades, the freer and more open Chinese economy became the more the Chinese prospered and the CCP regained its lost legitimacy. 3 decades after Deng's rule, close to 1 billion people were lifted out of poverty. Chinese citizens became world-class. Chinese technology became advanced in sheer numbers. The Chinese middle class became the largest in the world. But in the last few years, growth has started slow, with many predicting a downturn of has sought to preserve the economic benefits of Deng's market reforms while reimposing the centralized power and restrictions on free enterprise and speech, reconverting China into quasi-police state. The difference now is Xi Jinping. There we go. I knew I could say it. Has access to technology and Mao never dreamed of. Facial recognition, AI surveillance networks, mobile and internet monitoring, and social credit systems are being deployed to China once again. And like every social paradise, every socialist paradise into prison. Whew. The fact is, a large segment of American elite class and most productive industries have been purchased by the Chinese. Big tech, Wall Street, Hollywood, and the universities are all dependent on Chinese money and markets to keep their profits trending upward. Nearly all U.S. corporations, universities, and media rush to defend the actions and decision-making of the Chinese government, helping the CCP cover the origins of the virus by deeming anyone who disagreed with the official Beijing line a racist or crackpot or conspiracy theorist. And I read another book. It's The Red Something, and I'm sorry, I can't remember it. But I'm just saying I've read so much about this kind of stuff that the universities are getting money laundered through different ways, but they're getting it from China. And it's like, there's so much control going on that we don't even have a clue. We don't have a clue. The fact is America's China policy is not even really made by the American president. Anymore. It is made by the lobbyists, lobbying and interest groups, and oligarchical classes that are dependent on the Chinese market, regardless on the effect of ordinary American workers and consumers. The only hope for countering the spread of Chinese influence in the U.S. is the the only hope is the U.S., but the American elites are busy dismantling the sources of American economic and military power to the benefit of the Chinese in order to enrich themselves. Hello. Somebody's son comes to mind. If this process continues, there will be simply no hope for preventing a Chinese-dominated future for the world. All right. But we know that we have some things under our sleeve that can stop this. We just have to stand up and be willing to go against the grain. If you don't know that real freedom exists, then you will never know that real slavery exists too. And thus you never understood that, in fact, you are one of its victims, a slave in your own country. You know, when you've been told you live in paradise your whole life and it's not paradise, you don't really know what paradise is like. And so you don't really have any word for hell. You just are living in your world thinking this is all there is. I believe it's important to do so as an escape slave, as a free woman, as an American. It's my right and duty to recover the language I never had to describe the bondage of my youth and that poor souls that are poor souls still enslaved there. North Korea is a socialist state, a surviving vestige of the Marxist-Leninist dream of communist colonial nation of human history, a nuclear-armed totalitarian dictatorship that has enslaved 26 million human beings in the cult of personality around these three evil men, two of them dead, who have overseen the country-sized concentration camp. Again, in order to live is heart-wrenching. And I can't say to read one or the other, because they're both so powerful. But if I would say read one or the other, I would read the first one, because you don't know what you don't know until, and that's maybe why I'm exposing this book and doing this as the book by the bite, because the first one is just so powerful in a different way. This one relates it so much to her observation of what's going on in America, and very important too. But it's the Earth's longest running experiment in deliberately managed human misery, a perpetual crime against God, an interminable violation of human dignity, a black market on the human species so dark and deep that it could almost make you ashamed to be part of it, that it can make the individual human beings incarcerated there spend the eternity of their short lives dreaming and daydreaming of living in there instead of a bird, and living there as a bird or a mouse. Pay attention to the bird or the mouse thing, because it comes in pretty powerful here in a minute. All the generosity and kindness and altruism in the world can do nothing to reverse the damage. Of all the international food aid sent to North Korea, only a small percentage makes it into the hands and the mouth of the people who are outcasts. It doesn't make it into the hands of the people who are outcast and a total control zone, a prison camp for people considered enemies of the regime. Inmates. Oh, I'm sorry. That was another thing. So the food there doesn't get to the actual people. It's used in nefarious ways, and it's ridiculous. Okay, so this is the hardest part. So when people are taken to prison, they will do anything for you to renounce whatever it is you're supposed to renounce, and it'll cost you your life. But before it costs you your life, they bring your family there. They publicly denounce them because they could be connected to you, and they stone them so that the last thing they see before they die is that people they love most in the world, the last thing they see before they die is the people they love most in the world being made to participate in their murder. I mean, how horrendous is that? Okay. And here's where it's just so fun to me to connect the dots. You know, we're talking about, I just wanted to talk to you about the horrific situation in North Korea and what a gift it is where we live. And in the end of this book, she says, the 24-hour news cycles has exposed the corruption and incompetence of many of our political and cultural elites to the point where most Americans no longer have faith or trust in their elites. This, in turn, has led to historically low levels of voter participation in local and state politics, declining rates of church attendance and religious belief, and plummeting rates of family formation. So if you don't think we have elites in our city, it's everywhere. We have it in our city, we have it in our state, we have it in our nation. There are always elites who are running the show. And if we don't participate, a lot of us have stopped participating because we think it doesn't matter. And that's what they want us to do. They want to be able to do what they want to do without us having to cause problems. We don't have to cause problems. We just have to say, hey, listen, this is not the way it's set up. And we want to make an impact. And that's why we're doing this show as often as we are to the specific audience we're reaching right now. The response from the elite has not been to help these people, but to stigmatize them as racist, bigots, transphobes, and insurrectionists in order to justify their declining fortunes. The United States still has some of the most robust constitutional protections of any country in the world, and the American people's basic decency, commitment to freedom and liberty, and the skepticism of government will likely see us through. So, you know, what's interesting, I was just thinking about when I'm reading this that, you know, I did stand up and say that I was really disappointed that we would pick a controversial statue for the Storybook Gardens and to celebrate at the CAF in the summer. And no one argued with what I believed. They criticized me and said I was angry and I had too much time on my hands. They didn't argue my ideas. They criticized me. And it was then that I realized that it is a much harder battle to deal with because I know it didn't affect me, didn't change what I was going to do because I knew what the right thing was to do and I was going to do it. But how many people stood up against me for just sharing my beliefs? And it was a very well orchestrated group that all came together to stand in unison together in defiance of me having an opinion outside the group think. And it was sobering in a way that I don't think they understood. I think they thought they shut me down. I think they thought they showed that I was outnumbered. And I wasn't alone that day. There was a few other people there with me. But I'm just saying, I think they really wanted to shut it down. And it's crazy now just even thinking about how that affects us just for having an opinion about a statue, not by just saying like the ideas. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about ideas, but people who don't have very solid foundation for their belief systems, they can't attack ideas. They have to attack people because people expose the unsustainable position they're in, the untenable position they're in. And that's kind of shocking to me. It was very surprising. Okay. We have the cohesion, the belief in the rule of law, the confidence in democracy to see us through, or will we resort to trammeling the Bill of Rights, seeking to silence dissenters, muzzle freedom of speech, get rid of political enemies, and assent to the government, assuming indefinite emergency powers? Self-described scholars or woke activists or social justice warriors or... I wasn't supposed to read that quote. Sorry. This is where my lack of groove is getting off. I got on my talk. Okay, so will we be willing to stand up? Okay, last chapter, Freedom Matters. Almost there. It's always the memory of, okay, so she said, the truth is I don't like giving speeches very much or going to conferences or social events. I prefer to be at home with my son or alone with the books, but it's always the memory of my parents and some larger force in the universe that keeps urging me forward, constantly pushing me to do more, write more, speak out more. I could take credit for it all, but I'm old enough to know now that no one acts alone. When I found meaning in my life in being a mother and advocating for human rights, I also found that it didn't matter what kind of nightmares I had or how often I had them. No matter how much trouble I have sleeping or how awful my dreams, I always have reason to get out of the bed in the morning to be joyful and most of all to be grateful. We always have reason, even in the darkest times. And I love that she has shown that people are created to thrive. And if we just focus on that part, even in the hardest of times, you can find a way to do that miraculously, superhumanly, are beyond humanly possible. It's not enough to do you. It's just as important, if not more, to have purpose, set example for your children, and to devote yourself to something bigger. No matter what therapy, dieting, meditation, or self-care can do what meaning can do. The sheer abundance of material comfort has made... So she talks a lot about the comfort she's experienced in the land in America. And she says, the sheer abundance of material comfort has made me a bit soft and irritable in ways I was never before. The emphasis on individuality, finding your own voice and living your own truth made me a little less instinctively compassionate for other people than I had been, and I'd gotten in the habit of complaining when things didn't work and when people made mistakes or when events didn't go my way. How did we get to the point where American children and North Korean children are being fed similar propaganda about the United States? That's probably one of the most sobering things in the entire book. And that's why I'm probably pushing past the norms to do longer podcasts because I want to have these conversations and I'm going to start doing more of this in person. But right now, until we can get people gathered up and realize that it's safe to have these conversations, this is how we roll. In North Korea, the people you hear railing against America are underfed teachers, malnourished children, frightened parents, and elites whose livelihoods depend on the Kim crime family. That doesn't make their hatred and ignorance excusable, but at least it makes some sense. In America, however, the people railing against their own country are often overfed or obsessed with intentionally limiting the amount of food they eat. Often they will speak out against American history, society, capitalism, and democracy on an American social media platform from their American phone or computer or with the campus of the world-class American university or on the street with the permission of the American government, authorities, and protection of American police officers. North Koreans say such things because if they don't, they'll be shot. Americans do it because they think it's fun or because they want to acquire power and influence over people. When people become untethered from history, when they become unshackled from reality, when they lose the ability to understand cause and effect, they become ripe for exploitation for those who hold real power. You're confident that what's going on in America with these younger generations coming up like they are, you think it's a fad. It's never long before a fad fades away, giving away She talks about we have to be careful because these young people coming up being indoctrinated by these institutions, we think it's a fad, but it's not. It's not going away. They're now getting jobs and continuing on the process. But the fads are always going to keep coming and keep changing the measuring line. We must fight to preserve these freedoms as American because they're never a generation, more than a generation away from disappearing. One thing I love so much about Americans is that unlike any other people on the planet, when they face challenges, they become more cheerful and hopeful, not less. As we brace ourselves for the fight of our lifetime, we must not forget who we are. Okay. We've grown to distrust our American institutions and leaders. Okay, let's see here. All right, I missed the quote about Milton Friedman, but I'll have to come back with that another time. Okay, so here we go. Isn't this fun? I decided I was going to cover this book before I read it, just because I knew I had to read the book in order to do the podcast, at least about the first one. I just had to. And so we're about to wrap up of another long episode of Book by the Bite, but so as she says, go to your city council hearings, attend your local school board meetings, get involved in your hometown owners association, join civic groups that convene people with common interests, raise money to bring artists and performers from around the country to your town, become a leader in your local house of worship, and give back to the poor and the needy. Coach your children's sports teams, talk to them about America and our shared history together at the dinner table, read books to them at night, make sure they give back to their communities, limit your exposure to social media, constrain your diet of talk radio and cable news, ignore most of what happens in Washington, become the master of your domain. So I love that. That's a great way we're going to end. So thank you for sticking with me for part two. This is a great book, and I'm going to include hopefully some ways, a way for you to watch her actual interview with Eric Metaxas at Socrates in the City. If you look up Eric Metaxas, I can't say his name, Eric Metaxas and Socrates in the City with Yanomi Park. There's a powerful interview that I think is really neat to hear the words from her herself and just to hear what this amazing lady has overcome and how grateful we are that she has been willing to stand up and share the tragedies of what's going on in our nation. And may we be the people or the generation that stops this from going on. I don't know what that looks like, but let's not just worry about ourselves and our cush lives in America, but let's worry about how what happens in America affects the rest of the world. And I will say there was a president that really did. I don't know how much it affected the people inside the nation, but I know he stood up to this dear leader that is a dictator and a tyrant and a terrible person, and it affected so much. And so we need leadership that will help make America great, because what happens in America, it affects the rest of the world. And so, and it affects, you know, we just have more power than we understand, not because we have control over people, but what we set here as normal. It affects it, the rest of the world is downstream in some capacity. So anyway, thanks for listening to this podcast. Please subscribe and share with your family and friends on whatever platform you listen to so that we can get the word out about what's going on and how we can have relevant and timely topics, discussing culturally relevant topics, I guess is what I meant to say, and have the ability to discuss those with people around us so that we can be educated, informed, and empowered to make an impact in Abilene in the big country. Until next time.